So as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
Welcome to Rants and Reason. I am Chuck.
I am Karen.
I am a liberal.
And I am a conservative. But as Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we are not enemies, we are friends.
We are friends, and we have been friends through numerous technical difficulties in this recording this podcast.
Yes, there have been a lot.
And you have had your own issues.
Yeah, it's been a dramatic week. Last week, my daughter, who has her temporary license, got in a pretty significant car accident. She's okay, and the other driver is okay, but the car is not okay. So I'm very thankful that everybody's healthy and everything, but it caused for a lot of extra work this past week. And then I got sick with bronchitis. At the clinic, they told me that I was a day away from pneumonia. And I realized that that is not as serious as man flu, but it was not pleasant, and it explains why I sound like a dying goose. So I apologize to everyone that I sound like this.
You know that I do other podcasts, and I think I counted them up, and I've done about 400. Maybe 15 or 20 of those were done with me suffering from the man flu. But I was a gamer. And I just went on. I pushed through it.
Well, it's nice to know that you have such a strong constitution. Apparently, I do not. I did try to record a couple of times. And the first time, I was so out of it that I forgot to hit record. And second time, there were some issues. And it's been an adventure. That's what we'll call it, an adventure.
That would not have been a problem, you not hitting record, except for the fact that you did not inform me or realize it until about 40 minutes into the podcast.
Okay, can we stop talking about it now?
Oh, no, this is something I'm going to remind you of every week.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm glad that this is going to keep coming up over and over and over again. That's delightful.
But you're better now.
I am, yes.
And you're not? You haven't been drinking tonight, right?
I'm drinking tea.
Okay. Well, today we are going to talk about a subject that everyone is talking about.
Right.
We're going to talk about the NRA.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't want people to take away from this is not an attack on NRA members.
Right.
But you have to separate what the NRA does in the sporting and gun safety areas. And really, they're better at anyone at that.
They are.
Gun training, their safety training, their range master safety training. It's the industry standard for how you train people for gun safety.
Right.
However, you have a separate entity, the political arm of the NRA.
Yes.
And we are going to talk about what goes on in that, correct?
Right. Yeah, we want to bust the illusion that the GOP is fully, fully supportive of the NRA's political agenda. It's definitely something that appears to be true, but there's a lot more that goes into it, and we're gonna be talking about that today.
Yeah.
So,
yes, we are, and hope we can clear up some misinformation and provide you with good information.
Yes, that's the goal here. I've seen a lot of memes thrown about that the NRA started as a protective force for the Ku Klux Klan. But that's simply not true, right, Chuck? I mean, what is the real history of the NRA?
No, that's not true. I've seen that a number of times, and I've known that's not true for a long, long time.
But not everybody does know that. A lot of people—
No, they don't.
Are,
and it's interesting how it came about. It came about, you had Colonel William Church and General George Wingate. They were Union officers in the Civil War, And after the Civil War, they were really, really frustrated by how poorly the Union soldiers shot. Mm-hmm. So they decided to start this organization, and they called it the National Rifle Association in 1871. And their primary goal was to promote and encourage rifle shooting on a scientific basis.
Okay.
So they were really an organization that promoted shooting as a sport and promoted gun safety throughout the years. They had nothing mm-hmm. to do with the KKK.
Right. So, I mean, really, the initial purpose of the NRA had absolutely nothing to do with the Second Amendment, really.
Not really. Not really. In the beginning, and for years and years and years, the NRA supported legislation that promoted certain gun restrictions as a form of responsible gun ownership. And the big ones, when they started putting regulations into place, you had the National Firearms Act of 1934 mm-hmm. and the Gun Control Act of 1938. And that regulated certain guns. That's back when you had the Prohibition gang wars and the bank robbers, Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, right. guys like that. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to regulate the Tommy guns. They make gun dealers register with the government. And this was done with the help, support, and blessing of the NRA. And during the congressional hearing, this is really interesting, Carl Frederick, who was the president of the NRA in 1934, said, "I have never believed in the general practice of carrying weapons. I seldom carry one.
Wow.
I do not believe in the general promiscuous toting of guns. I wow. think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses."
It's amazing. It's amazing the difference in the tone then and the tone that you hear now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then you get up to 1963 when Kennedy got assassinated. Mm-hmm. And Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the person who allegedly, and I'm using air quotes even on allegedly, shot Kennedy. And we're going to have to do a Karen's Conspiracy Corner on that one day.
Me or you? I think maybe that one we need a Chuck's Conspiracy Corner, but carry on.
Well, anyway, he bought that rifle from an NRA magazine. So they wanted to introduce legislation so people couldn't do that. It didn't really get any traction. But then in 68, you had Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King both mm-hmm. assassinated. That's when they put in the Gun Control Act of 1968. And that basically regulated interstate firearm commerce. It was supported by the NRA. It eliminated mail order gun purchases, because up until that time, you could buy a 22 or a gun or whatever from the Sears Roebuck catalog or an NRA magazine. So it outlawed all that. At the hearings, you had Franklin Orth. He was the executive vice president of the NRA, and he supported a ban on mail order sales. And he said, "We do not think any sane American who calls himself an American can object to placing into this bill the instrument which killed the president of the United States." Mm. You can see that you have a completely different tone now.
Yeah, definitely.
You had them cooperating with the government, trying to figure out what kind of legislation, what legislation was best. And then there came a turn. And you have to remember now, in 68, there was a lot of social chaos. And you had a lot of people turning to the NRA for practical application on defense if mm-hmm. they needed it.
Right. So it sounds like initially the NRA really had very little to do with politics, right? I mean, it sounded like it was much more of a tool for citizenry than a source of any kind of actual policy. What transformed the organization into the lobby that we see that it is today?
There were a couple things, but the really defining incident that shifted the focus of the NRA was in 1971, the ATF and local law enforcement officials raided the home of Kim Ballew. He was a firearms collector, and he was accused of having a stockpile of unlicensed weaponry, including grenades.
That's not good.
Now, it is not. And the grenades made this a federal issue. Mm-hmm. So the ATF was brought in. there's a lot of controversy as to what happened. You have two different sides. The ATF said one thing, Ballou said another. Mm-hmm. Basically, they broke down his door with a battering ram. He thought he was being burglarized. He grabbed a pistol. Now, the pistol was a single-shot cap-and-ball Civil War replica. And he was standing in his living room naked when the police broke down the door and came in.
Was the naked part really necessary to the story?
It actually was necessary to the story because he said he was in the bathtub, and when he was shot, he was completely dry, and he had a woman in the house with nothing on but her underwear.
Okay. I was just curious because I just wondered if you just added that in there for flair or carry on.
Well, I think anytime someone's naked in one of our stories, we need to point it out.
I guess that's true.
So they shot him in the head, and he obviously thought this was greatly unjust, and the NRA.
So he lived. Membership,
because he did live. Yes,
I mean, if he was shot in the head and lived to think it was unjust, then, you know, that means he was not dead.
Well, I think if he would have got shot in the head at least for a quarter of a second, he would have thought it was unjust, even if he died.
That's true. But he did live.
But he did live. Okay. Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. So anyway, here's the problem you have with this man.
Okay.
He was a pressman at the Washington Star, a newspaper. So it made it into the media because one of the newspaper people were shot. Mm-hmm. He was a Boy Scout troop leader. Mm-hmm. He had been in the Air Force and came out with a clean military record as a security policeman in the Air Force.
Okay.
He had no criminal convictions, except for an arrest for carrying a concealed weapon, but that wasn't a conviction. That was dropped.
Okay.
So as ex-military, it wasn't odd to own a lot of souvenir weapons. He was a collector. Nor was it odd to have dummy grenades.
Okay. So being a collector, that meant he was like a very avid member of the NRA, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And his shooting really angered a lot of members of the NRA because, again, his story was, I was in the bathtub minding my own business. They broke down the door, came in, and shot me. Hmm. And, of course, the ATF said they identified themselves. So there was a big controversy over that. Mm-hmm. This angered a lot of members of the NRA, and it resulted in a lot of significant changes to the ruling body of the NRA. This brewed for a while. But to address it, the NRA's top managers created the group's first lobbying organization. It's called the Institute for Legislative Action. That's what they use today. And they created it in 1975. Now, the ILA was headed by a Texas lawyer named Harlan Carter. And he was an immigration hawk who had headed the Border Patrol in the 1950s. And he was a real, real hard ass. I mean, he was no compromise, no retreat, no surrender. And he is where the NRA took the turn.
Yes. I think it's really, really important to highlight the character of Harlan Carter because it's something many NRA members don't know. The current leadership refers to Carter as a hero and a warrior for the cause. In fact, there's even a high school with his name. But those were not characteristics that most people would use to define this man. When Harlan Carter was 17, he shot and killed a 15-year-old Mexican boy right in front of two younger boys. Testimony indicates that Carter's mother had noticed three Hispanic boys kind of hanging out, loitering outside their home. A car had been stolen the previous week, and she was concerned that the young men may be there for this for similar intent. So she asked Carter to go check on it, and Harlan took a rifle out and insisted that the boys, who ranged in ages from 12 to 15, to come to his house. I don't know what he was going to do once they got there, but of course they refused. And one of the boys ended up pulling a knife and asking Harlan if he wanted to fight. Harlan responded by pointing the gun at the boy's chest. The boy moved the gun aside, laughed, and said, "You don't want to do that." This comment upset Harlan Carter, who responded with, "You think I won't?" And Carter then shot and killed him. He was convicted of murder and he was sentenced with 3 years. He didn't serve his full sentence. There was some judicial involvement regarding the question of self-defense. But he went on, strangely enough, I don't know if his record got expunged or what, because he went on to serve at the Border Patrol.
It was overturned.
Okay. And when he was at the Border Patrol, he created a program called Operation Wetback. I apologize to any listeners for the terminology being used here, but that's what it was. Carter was quoted in the Los Angeles Times as describing this operation as an army of Border Patrol officers complete with jeeps, trucks, and 7 aircraft who would wage all-out war to hurl Mexican wetbacks back into Mexico. So you can see that he was a very pleasant person who truly believed in the value of life for everyone. Harlan Carter also was accused of stealing a lot of government ammunition. And when we say a lot, we're talking, what was it, 40,000
rounds? 40,000 rounds.
Yeah.
And I'm going to call shenanigans on this just real quickly.
Okay.
The Rio Grande is a big river. Okay.
Okay.
Now, when he says he's hurling Mexicans back, he said he had jeeps and all kinds of stuff, but he didn't say he had a catapult. He didn't say he had this really huge slingshot. You can't just hurl people back into Mexico.
Okay, so what we're establishing here is he was not a very kind person, nor was he a very smart man.
Or truthful. So. He wasn't hurling anybody.
There you go.
And plus, what if he would have run across someone from, say, Guatemala? I mean, what were they going to do with them then?
Okay, I'm going to go
throw
them
all the way
story.
Back to Guatemala?
Thank you for your observations. We're going to move forward here. When Harlan Carter was chosen for the ILA, a news reporter came up with a story describing his past when he was a young man and the murder of the young Mexican boy. And Harlan Carter at first said, oh, that wasn't me. I didn't have anything to do with that. There was a weird spelling of someone's name. Wasn't me. I don't know. And obviously he was confronted with facts and at that point had to admit that it was him. And he issued some very weak statements saying something along the lines of, fatalities are always unfortunate. That was it. That is the character of Mr. Carter.
Yeah, you can forget a lot of things. But you don't really forget, I would think, shooting someone in the chest when you were 17.
And if you do, that says a lot about the kind of person that you are.
Well, yeah, I've forgotten a lot of things, but I'm pretty sure I haven't shot anyone and forgotten about it. So anyway, yes, he was a hardliner. And one of his mottos was, you don't stop crime by attacking guns, you stop crime by stopping criminals. Now, he was pretty soon at odds with the old guard of the parent NRA.
Right, so who was focused on sporting, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They were gun safety. They wanted to become kind of a more prestigious organization. They were going to build this really, really nice new headquarters that he used against them, mm-hmm. saying they were wasting money. Okay. They decided to put him in his place, and they really cut down his ILA staff down to nothing. Well, he decided he was going to fight back, and he organized an uprising at the annual NRA convention in 1977, right here in Cincinnati, and forced a power struggle. And this became known as the Cincinnati Revolution. Now, members within the NRA, activist members, ended up electing Carter as executive director, and a man named Neil Knox, who was just as much a hardliner as Carter, as head of the NRA ILA. Hmm. Now, Carter believed that no gun control legislation could be acceptable, none whatsoever. He wrote to NRA membership, we can win this on a simple concept. No compromise, no gun legislation. Carter was just completely opposed to any kind of background checks for gun purchases, even including violent criminals and the mentally ill. And when a reporter asked him about that stance, Carter stated that if a criminal were to murder his children, it's the price we pay for freedom.
Wow.
So now Carter remained in this position until 1985, and under his leadership, they really did grow. They went from 1 million members to 3 million members. Their budget obviously increased a great deal, but their political influence really, really exponentially increased.
Yeah. You know, I understand that culture had changed a lot during that time period, that there was a lot of fear over the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, and that had to alarm a lot of people. There were all the assassinations, there was rising crime, and things like that would naturally cause a fearful response. And it's truly unfortunate that a group that was well known and well respected for training and safety became fearmongers almost, and they did a really good job at what they did from that point forward, didn't they? I mean, they definitely had a real strategy that they employed moving forward.
Absolutely. Fear was part of that strategy. The other part of that strategy was, mm-hmm. as conservatives, not down to a person, but as a rule, mm-hmm. they don't trust the government a lot. They don't trust that centralized power. They don't trust
right. –
it's not that they don't trust the government. They don't trust all that power in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I would definitely say – I think a lot of people paint conservatives as anti-government, and it's not really anti-government as much as it is anti-centralized power, just like you said. So I just wanted to make sure that I clarify that.
Yeah, I should have said that right to begin with. But that's what they didn't trust, is a centralized power in Washington, D.C., and the NRA used that as part of their strategy, used that fear of that centralized power as part of their strategy. And they were far more effective than anybody would have thought. And they developed really a playbook. And this is what you have to understand. When you're listening to the news and you're seeing all these stories and you're seeing the town halls where – you know, the students are saying to Rubio, are you not going to take NRA money? The NRA's power is not about money. It's not about money at all. Obviously,
right?
They do give a lot of money, but mm-hmm. that money comes through PACs, not really through individual donations to politicians. Mm-hmm. So when you hear about politicians being in the pocket of the NRA, that's really not true because they don't give them a lot of money.
Right.
They spend a lot of money on political activism through their PAC, but their big force is their membership and their ability to drive their membership and motivate their membership. And that is really where they've found success. Because, okay, for the past 8 years, we have Barack Obama in office. And he gave the mm-hmm. National Rifle Association the perfect liberal boogeyman. I mean, members were bombarded with messages all the time that their rights were in peril. They were going to have their guns taken away, things like that. And Obama was the perfect person to have in office for that. So you take a lot of people who don't trust that centralized power and you tell them, hey, this power is going to come after you. It's a pretty effective message.
It is.
And you have to understand that they have to create a culture war and make Americans afraid of each other. You know, that's
right.
What works for them.
Right. And no place did that work as well as it did when they started in Florida.
Exactly.
Right?
And one thing to note, how effective this was, in the 8 years under Obama, gun manufacturers mm-hmm. sold more guns than any time in history. Gun sales actually
right.
dropped.
We're actually going to go into...
We
yes.
got a new president.
We're going to kind of go into fundraising and things like that that occurred because of it, too, here in just a
yeah.
little bit, right? I mean, it's incredible how tragedy, how many people have capitalized from tragedy. It's really disgusting.
But their playbook, to get back to that, it starts in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in Florida.
Yeah.
They have one lobbyist, Marianne Hammer, in Florida. Normally, they have regional lobbyists. But Florida has its own dedicated one because Florida is the laboratory for the NRA. And what they do is they basically write legislation Because you have to understand, in Florida, since 1998, it has been completely Republican control. So in most districts, it's not, is the Democrat or Republican going to win? It's which Republican is going to win. And really, that depends on their rating, oftentimes, what their rating is from the NRA. That's why they carry so much influence. Because if a person wants to get elected, they have to have the backing of the NRA. So they start in Florida because it's so heavily Republican throughout the state, you know, on the state level. And they create these laws. I mean, they created the first Stand Your Ground law in Florida. Now 31 states have it. And Stand Your Ground is such an really an aberration of self-defense that we would have thought it was so strange 30 years ago that you could carry a concealed weapon and not have to retreat before you shot someone to death. But now again, they've moved that to 31 states, and that is what they do, is they normalize things in Florida. They create laws in Florida, they normalize them, and then they move them to other red states. And by red states, I mean states that at the state level, there's a Republican governor, the Senate's controlled by the Republicans, and the House is controlled by the Republicans. And that's in 26 states right now. So they take these laws from Florida, and then they move them to these states. Okay, and it's really, really been effective for them. But it all starts with Florida, what they can get passed in Florida, and then they normalize it, and then they move it to other states. And it's a really, really effective plan. I mean, it's worked very, very well for them. Also, another tactic they use is, aside from political pressure, is payback. If a politician tries to introduce any kind of legislation with just a hint of gun control, they risk an immediate attack in the media and direct mailers and everything else, painting them as not only anti-Second Amendment, but anti-American. So no matter how well-intentioned these laws may be, many of these lawmakers are just unable to stand against the wave that this NRA unleashes upon them. And although most of the attacks are against Democrats, if Republicans do it and they don't fall into lockstep with the NRA, they get targeted, and they get targeted harshly. And one of these examples you know about is Deborah Maggart.
Yeah. In 2012, a prominent state lawmaker in Tennessee, Deborah Maggart, had been one of the NRA's strongest allies in the state. She had an A-plus rating. She was a very reliable vote. The NRA wanted to pass a piece of legislation that ran into some obstacles from the state's business community. Maggart ultimately decided to just table the legislation. She didn't even oppose it. She just reflected the will of the people, did her job. And the idea was that once it was tabled, they would just study it some more. But that wasn't good enough for the NRA. They didn't like that. So they spent no less than $50,000 putting a bunch of billboards up in her district that showed her and President Obama, who they had already painted as a gun grabber, together on a billboard. So they were equating her with President Obama. And the whole thing was a complete falsehood. Then the NRA backed a candidate who had no political experience, but who was further to the right on the political spectrum, and they ended up primarying her with the billboards and a few YouTube advertisements that called her a gun grabber. Her ratings dropped. So she had been someone who was very popular in her district, but she ended up being primaried and losing because of the NRA.
And they have done that. She's just an example. I mean, that's kind of the formula that they use in this payback, but they have done it time and time and time again to numerous people. So we just gave that as an example. We could get 15 more if we wanted to.
Right, right. Another really important issue that we need to talk about regarding the NRA is the widening rift between the NRA and law enforcement. And this is really important because a lot of conservatives talk about backing the blue. They talk about wanting law and order. And if that's the case, they really need to listen to what law enforcement is saying about gun safety and guns on the street. It's really, really important.
Yeah, when it comes to law enforcement, they portray themselves as very friendly to law enforcement or friend to law enforcement. And you really would be hard-pressed to find any political organization that's less police friendly. I mean, the NRA has opposed every single measure that law enforcement has put forth in their efforts to curb gun violence. In fact, the idea of the average citizen, the good guy with a gun, thwarting crimes is almost universally opposed by law enforcement. The other thing police don't like is open carry laws. They hate them,
right,
which they say just makes their job more difficult, stressful, and dangerous. And instead of listening to these criticisms, those who continue to demand unfettered gun rights endanger the same police lives they claim to want to protect. I'm going to give you a quote here. You can't be the party of law and order and not listen to your police chiefs. That's Art Acevedo. He was a police chief of Austin when he admonished the state's Republican lawmakers recently. And on the heels of the Dallas shooting, where five officers were left dead, Police Chief David Brown said open carry had made the task of identifying the shooter harder.
Chief Brown also made some comments. I don't have the quotes in front of me, but I remember him making some comments regarding his lackluster feel. I mean, he did not like assault weapons being on the street. He definitely made a lot of comments in the media regarding that.
Yeah, and so he had five officers killed by an assault rifle. And
exactly.
In Dallas, you can just carry one around. Okay, here's something that's really, really, really going to aggravate you. After Sandy Hook, NRA donations rose 350% from the prior year.
So disgusting. We touched on this earlier when you talked about gun manufacturers capitalizing off of tragedy. And seeing the donations rise to that level is just, it's really disgusting. There should be things that you don't ever try to fundraise off of. And that's definitely one of them.
Well, there was a lot of talk. You remember after Sandy Hook, there was a lot of talk of banning assault rifles.
Right.
And they sent out a lot of mailers and said that, hey, here they come after your guns. And they got a ton of money. They used it even in the Oklahoma City bombing they did. And the standoff in the siege in Waco, that was really used as a prop for fundraising. And that was in 93 when President Clinton was in office. And at that time, the NRA, he was the executive, just an executive for the NRA, Wayne LaPierre. He's now the president. He sent a letter to members that said, in Clinton's administration, if you have a badge, you have the government's go-ahead to harass, intimidate, even murder law-abiding citizens. LaPierre also made reference to them wearing Nazi bucket helmets and black stormtrooper uniforms. And this was a bad thing for him to say because it angered many, many in his own membership because they felt themselves friends with law enforcement.
Right.
And they couldn't believe that he was saying this about law enforcement,
you know,
the people that were supposed to protect us.
Yes. Yes. I have a letter here I'd like to read a little bit of a lifetime NRA member and the letter that they wrote to the NRA after that particular incident. It says, I was outraged when, even in the wake of the Oklahoma City tragedy, Mr. Wayne LaPierre, executive president of the NRA, defended his attack on federal agents as jackbooted thugs. To attack Secret Service agents or ATF people or any government law enforcement people as wearing Nazi helmets and black stormtrooper uniforms and wanting to attack law-abiding citizens is a vicious slander on good people. And they ended the letter with, I am a gun owner and an avid hunter. Over the years, I have agreed with most of the NRA's objectives, particularly the educational and training efforts and the fundamental stance in favor of owning guns. However, your broadside against federal agents deeply offends my own sense of decency and honor. and it offends my concept of service to country. It indirectly slanders a wide array of government law enforcement officials who are out there, day and night, laying their lives on the line for all of us. You have not repudiated Mr. LaPierre's unwarranted attack. Therefore, I resign as a lifetime member of the NRA, said resignation to be effective upon the receipt of this letter. Please remove my name from your membership list. Sincerely, George Bush.
Yeah, and that was pretty powerful, and that was pretty publicized. That was pretty well publicized at the time.
And it says a lot about how radical some of the political ideology coming from the NRA is and how different it is from its roots. And from the side of it that is just a shooting training safety group.
Well, from the political side, it is just don't budge.
Yeah.
Don't give an inch. Don't compromise. Don't do anything. You don't have to. I mean, that's what Harlan Carter said.
You know, I'm just going to – can I go off about something? We didn't plan this, but I just want to go off about something.
Well, you haven't had your conspiracy corner, so we'll give you your rant corner. Go ahead.
It's not a conspiracy, but when did compromise become a sign of weakness? It is much, much harder to sit at a table and hash out differences and come to some type of common ground than it is to just keep your opinion. That's not a sign of strength. It's not a sign of strength to say, oh, I will not budge on this. What is a sign of strength is to say, you know what? Maybe I'm wrong in this area, and I'm willing to sit here and discuss this with you. That is strength. I'm done.
Well, and some things aren't even compromising. I mean, you have a Quinnipiac poll that shows 97% of Americans right now want universal background checks on all gun sales, including private gun sales and gun show sales.
Well, 73% of NRA members want that, want
exactly.
Universal background checks. 73%.
Right now, after three, if you take the top 10 worst mass shootings in our country, three have happened in the last 5 months. And right now in Washington, they're not even talking about universal background checks.
So what do we do to solve the problem?
It's easy. And here's why they're not talking about it. Because after that, you can bet that senators got just tons and tons of calls and emails from NRA members.
Yes.
And it's not enough. We think that we can make our voices heard through Facebook, through Twitter, through polls, through whatever, through arguing with our friends. Now, the way you make your voice heard is you use the NRA's playbook against them. You call your congressman. You call your state representative. You call your local representative. You email them. I mean, I'm that grumpy man who knows all their email addresses, and I will send them a letter in a heartbeat. But that's what you have to do, because if they come in the office in the morning and they have 200 emails from NRA members saying you better not do anything with gun rights, and they have 10 from constituents saying I want you to do something about gun rights, whose voice do you think they're going to hear? We have to be a louder voice, and it's easy to be a louder voice because people who want common sense gun legislation put in place greatly outnumber those who don't.
Yes.
But we have to let our senators and our congressmen and our state legislators know that.
Right.
And we don't. We don't. I mean, we really were just all too lazy to shoot off an email. That's all it takes, is shooting off an email. If they get inundated with emails and phone calls, they will then walk in and say, wow, this is a loud voice I'm hearing. Right. I better do something.
Yes. And that's the thing that people don't seem to realize. You know, all I hear is, you know, the NRA has this politician in their pocket and this one in their pocket. And It's not that simple. They're listening to their constituents. They're listening to their community. And when what the information they're getting is, don't infringe on our rights, and that's the loudest voice in the room, that's who they're going to use to craft their policy. So exactly. It's just making excuses if you say that they're going off of the information that they have. And if that's the information they have, that is nobody's fault but those that do not speak up.
Right. And I'll give you an example. In Florida, they have 300,000 members. Florida has 8 million voters.
Right.
But do you know what those 300,000 members do? Number one, they vote.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, they call and they send emails.
They mobilize.
They mobilize. And by mobilizing, I don't mean making a sign and marching down the damn street, because that doesn't do any good at all.
Yeah.
When you want to get this kind of legislation passed, you have to make sure that they hear your voice, because they can see a march on Washington. But hell, they assume that, you know what, my constituency is primarily Republican and this is what the Republicans want. Well, because that's all they've heard. They haven't heard from Republicans. They've heard from the NRA.
Right.
So they say, this is what I better do.
Yes. Yes. And that brings it to those of us on the right. We have to stop allowing the reasonable candidates to get primaried by the NRA. We need to let our candidates know it's okay for you to not have an A+ rating. Have common sense gun control. And at the same time, protect our Second Amendment rights. It's okay to not be unable to budge on something. We need to free our politicians. So we really need to do that on the right. We also need to fight against propaganda. When you get an email, say, hypothetically speaking, you've been a donor, and the NRA gets your name off of a GOP donor list, and you get an email stating legislation is coming that is going to take your guns away. Look up that legislation, read it, and then disseminate true information. Because I guarantee you what you're going to find in that bill is radically different than the headline of that email. I see all the time now from reputable or fairly reputable news sites, I see headlines that reference bills that when I look up the actual bill, and it's not that hard to read a bill. Every bill has a short summary at the beginning of it that basically tells you what's in the bill. So you don't have to speak legalese to read a bill. Just find out what's really in it before you start getting afraid of it.
Right.
Fight against the propaganda.
And that's what you have to do. We got caught up in that because with the Conyers bill, there were two bills.
Mm-hmm.
And when they said they were going to vote on it, one of them was reciprocity of concealed carry across state lines,
mm-hmm.
which meant that if you had a concealed carry in one state, it was good in every state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the governors hate that. The governors hate it because they want to control the laws in their states as to who has concealed weapons.
Right.
The bill that got introduced, it looked like that was in the bill. It was reported actually by one place that was in the bill. And we looked up the bill and found out, no, there were two bills. One had it in it. They didn't introduce that bill in the Senate. The bill they put in the Senate did not have that in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very easy to get caught up, and you have to look. You can get caught up in the kind of a false narrative.
Right. The passion of it. I understand
right. Not
wanting to have your right infringed. I understand on wanting to keep your community safe. But don't let your emotions drive anger that doesn't need to be there. Read the information and arm yourself with information instead of passion. That's ultimately what you have to do. I also want to take a second and I want to talk to the left for a moment. I want to explain the ideology of the right and I want to make a suggestion. So we on the right are very, very skittish, right? We're very nervous about any type of rights being taken away because we've seen them when we've given a little bit, we've seen that expanded past where we're comfortable. So we tend to be, don't go anywhere near my boundaries. Frame the gun narrative to be responsible gun ownership instead of gun control. Because we hear the word gun control, we hear that terminology, and we think you want to control my life. You want to control every aspect of my life. That's how we hear it. And it's not true. And I know that. But that's what part of the reason that you see such passion on the right. Like, you don't get to control my life and tell me what I can and cannot do. Fact of the matter is, a lot of Republicans believe in good citizenship. So frame the narrative to be responsible gun owners. And Republicans hear that, because we need to be responsible gun ownership. We're always talking about personal responsibility, that we have individual responsibility to be good citizens. Here, we have a personal responsibility to be good citizens. And there are things we need to do regarding gun control to do that. So be responsible gun owners, because you're not being a responsible gun owner if you're allowing anybody and everybody to have a weapon.
I definitely agree with you. And if you get to speak to the left, I'm going to speak to the right for 1 minute, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Here's what the right needs to understand, and especially the hardliners in the NRA. Public opinion is turned, and if people mobilize, you're not going to get compromise.
That's right.
What you're going to get is a house that flips in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And you are going to have gun legislation passed that you are absolutely not going to want.
Yep.
You could get by right now. I mean, some compromises right now. The universal background check. Everybody wants that. Even the NRA membership wants that. The NRA leadership does not want that. But my point being, if you're not going to compromise, this is going to be a political issue in 2018.
And it's going to be.
It's probably going to be a political issue in 2020 because, again, we've just had three of our worst gun shootings in the last 5 months. And there's probably statistically going to be another one between now and the election.
Right.
And if nobody's doing anything, that's an issue that the Democrats are going to capitalize on. They're going to control the House possibly with it. And then you're going to see measures that are much, much
more stringent.
Further reaching.
Yes, more stringent.
Than you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that a lot of people want. So it's a matter of sitting down and saying, we have a problem. How do we solve this problem? And where do we go with it?
Be strong enough to be wrong. Be strong enough to be wrong, to go to the table and say, you know what? I've been very, very stubborn on this issue and I need to give.
Damn right. I'm wrong all the time.
So. I'm wrong sometimes. I'm strong enough to say that.
I'm like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm so wrong. So, but that's what we want to do. Mm-hmm. This was really meant to inform you and remind you that the NRA is really kind of like the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain. You know, the NRA is getting blamed for all this, but we've given them the power.
Right.
Because we haven't taken power.
Yeah, exactly.
We haven't taken control of these issues.
Right.
So you can't sit around and just keep pointing the finger at the NRA when you're not willing to do something yourself. And by doing something, I mean calling your damn senator, calling your congressman. Tweeting isn't enough. Facebook isn't enough. Arguing with people on Facebook isn't enough. You have to tell the congressman this is what you want.
Yes. Your senator does not see that really incredibly articulate Facebook thread that you started, that everybody is telling you how wonderful you are. Your senator doesn't see that.
No.
Nope.
And, you know, this is off the subject, but one of the tricks I've learned is both the senators we have in Ohio, I have donated to both of them. And the reason for that is if I shoot an email to Rob Portman, you know what? My name shows up on his donor list.
That's clever.
And maybe it's going to get listened to.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going to at least get read. Every time I send one, I get a response, and it's not necessarily just a form response. I know it's from an aide, and I know Rob Portman's not sitting down. But I know somebody's reading it, and if he gets enough of them, they're going to tell him, hey, you got 20 emails today regarding this, and 20 of them were donors. So that's a weird little trick, but people do it all the time.
That's very clever.
So, well, I'm a clever man.
You are.
I'm a clever, clever man. I was clever enough to get someone as smart as you to do a podcast.
Thank you, Karen. And I want to thank you for all the hard work that you put in researching this particular episode. I was obviously not my best for this episode, and I really, really appreciate the effort that you put into it, Chuck. Thank you very, very, very much.
Well, you're very welcome. You're the one who typically is our research guru, so I got to do it this week, and it was kind of fun.
Yeah, it was good.
So I would like...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
I would like to thank everyone who interacts on our Facebook group,
mm-hmm.
the Rants and Reason podcast group. And we especially want to thank our moderators.
Yeah, we love you guys. You're amazing. And we're so, so thankful because you help keep an environment that allows for real conversations and real debate. And we're really, really thankful for that.
If you want to find us, look on iTunes.
You should totally do that.
And if you look on iTunes, please, please, please leave a review and please make it about me. You can find us on Podbean.
Or me.
Or you can leave a review about Karen, but don't say that she's prettier than he is. I hate that.
Well,
we've had two of those, I believe.
I mean,
Well, it's just rude. You can find us on Stitcher. I'm not defensive. Why are you saying I'm defensive?
I didn't say a word.
But yes, it would mean an awful lot to us if you left us a positive review.
It would. It would. And
we really appreciate you interacting with us on our podcast group. It's been very nice to have the conversation.
It is. I mean, we have people who are hard left and hard right that are actually conversing without calling each other names. It's pretty cool to see. I think it's a challenge for everybody in the group, for all of us to kind of not speak from emotion, and it challenges us all to find facts. And it's been a cool experiment, and I'm really thankful for it. We met some new friends through Twitter, and I'm very, very excited to have them. And we would love for you to follow us on Twitter at Rants Reason. So
that's
you can
right.
find us there. So you did most of the research for this episode. That's true. But I did find kind of a fun story that I wanted to share. Chuck, did you know that Cory Booker and Rand Paul were really good friends?
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah. What bonded them was that they both celebrate the Seinfeld-created holiday of Festivus.
I love the holiday of Festivus.
Right?
It's the airing of the grievances.
Yes.
And I have some problems with you people.
So it kind of makes sense that both Rand Paul and Cory Booker would appreciate Festivus.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, every once in a while, they'll watch Seinfeld together or they'll do something with Festivus together. And that just proves that
they can do it.
We can do it too.
That's right.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.